Reckon. Yeah. Have you told her I live in Wales? I've told her you live in a sheep pen. He threw the butts in the toilet because he knew I hated that smell too. I put both my hands on his shoulders. This has been a fucking shit week, mate. Don't worry about it. Let's just go back in a room and finish off the brew. Then you just go and sort your shit out with Simmons and get it over and done with. How was the burger?
Fine. I saved you and some fries.
I sat on the bed next to her. Listen, Kelly, me and Ewan have been talking, and because I've got to do some stuff in London, we reckon it's a good idea if you go to the countryside with him and stay at his house. It's only for one night. I'll be back tomorrow. What do you think? Hey, you can even see the floor we laid. Remember, I talked about it. She suspected she wasn't being offered any option, and her face said so. I said, I won't be long, and Ewan's house has sheep all around it. She looked down at her fingers and mumbled, I want to stay with you. I said with mock surprise,
what, don't you want to go? You'll see all the sheep.
She was embarrassed. She was too polite to say no in front of Ewan. I said, it won't be for long. Then, like a bastard, I closed the trap.
You like Ewan, don't you?
She nodded, never losing eye contact with me in case she made it with Ewan. It's just going to be for one night. I'll be calling you anyway. I'll be able to talk to you. She looked very unhappy about it. After all, I'd promised not to leave her again. I caught sight of my mobile and had an idea. What if I give you my telephone? I'll show you how to use it. I started playing with the buttons.
Here you are.
You have a go. If I show you how to use it, you can put that under your pillow tonight, all right? I looked up at Ewan, trying to bring him into it.
Because she'll have her own bedroom, won't she?
That's right. She'll have her own bedroom. The one that overlooks the sheep pen. I said, and I believe there's a TV in her bedroom, isn't there?
Yes, there's a TV in there.
He nodded and agreed, probably wondering where he was going to get one from. There was an acceptance. She wasn't over the moon about it, but that was good enough. I switched on the phone, tapped in my PIN number and handed it over. Just plug the charger into the wall when you get back, and it'll keep working, okay?
Okay.
Then put it underneath your pillow, so when it rings, you'll be sure to hear it.
All right. Whatever.
By now she understood that she definitely had no choice. Ewan said,
I'll tell you what, we'd better get your teddies organised if we're going to the country. What are their names? Have they ever been on a train before?
She warmed to him. We went downstairs and got in a taxi to Paddington Station. Chapter 38. We bought her ice creams, sweets, drinks, anything to keep her mind off what was happening. She was still deciding what comic to have as Ewan looked at his watch and said,
Wheel's turning soon, mate.
I went with them along the platform and gave her a big hug at the carriage door. I'll ring you tonight, Kelly, I promise. As she climbed up, Jenny and Ricky were looking at me from the Virgin day sack on her back.
Okay.
The guard was walking the length of the train, closing the doors. Ewan lowered the window so Kelly could wave.
Nick.
She leaned towards me through the open window and beckoned as if she wanted to whisper something.
What?
I put my face near hers.
This.
She threw her arms around my neck, squeezed, and planted a big kiss on my cheek. I was so taken aback I just stood there. The train started moving.
I'll see you tomorrow,
Ewan called.
Don't worry about us. We'll be okay.
As the train slowly disappeared from the platform, I felt the same wrench as at the moment I'd seen Pat's body being loaded into the ambulance. But this time I couldn't work out why. After all, it was for the best, and she was in safe hands. Forcing myself to see it as one more problem out of the way, I headed for the payphones.
I got a very businesslike reply from Vauxhall.
Extension, please.
2612. There was a pause, then a voice I recognised at once. Hello? 2612.
It's Stone. I've got what you needed.
Nick, where are you?
I put my finger in my ear as a departure was announced.
I'm in England.
Not that he needed me to say that, when he could hear that the Exeter train was leaving in 5 minutes.
Excellent. I'm pretty desperate to see you.
Likewise, but I'm tied up here until the early hours.
He paused to think.
Perhaps we can go for a walk and a talk. Let's say 4:30 tomorrow morning.
Where?
I'll walk towards the station. I presume you'll find me.
I'll do that.
I put the phone down with a feeling that at long last the dice were rolling for me. Kelly was safe. Simmons sounded amenable. With luck, I was only hours from sorting out this mess. Back at the hotel, I ordered a hire car to go and pick up Kelly from Brecon after the meeting, and had something to eat. In my head, I ran through exactly what I was going to say to Simmons, and the way I was going to say it. Without a doubt, I had in my possession precisely the sort of evidence Simmons had asked for. It was a shame I didn't have the videotape to back some of it up, but even so, the stuff I had was probably more than he could have hoped for. The worst-case scenario now was that I'd get the slate wiped clean and be let loose. At least I had a few quid to start a new life with. I thought about Kelly. What would become of her? Where would she go? Would she have been affected by everything she'd seen and all that had happened to her and her family? I tried to cut away from that, telling myself that it would all get sorted out. Somehow. Simmons could help there. Perhaps he could orchestrate the reunion with her grandparents, or at least point me in the direction of the right kind of expert help. I tried to get some sleep, but failed. At 3 a.m, I retrieved the hire car from an NCP car park and headed for Vauxhall Bridge. I went a long way round, going all the way down the King's Road to World's End, then turning for the river and heading east again, mainly because I wanted to organise my thoughts one last time. But also because, to me, the drive along the deserted embankment and past all the historic, flood-lit bridges offered one of the most beautiful sights in the world. This particular night, the lights seemed to shine a bit brighter, and the bridges seemed more sharply in focus, and I found myself wishing Kelly was there to see it all with me. I got to Vauxhall Bridge early. I drove east along the road that follows the river towards the next bridge, Lambeth. Nothing looked suspicious at the RV point on the drive past. The petrol station on the opposite side of the road, about halfway towards Lambeth Bridge, had about 4 cars on the forecourt. Groups of kids buying fuel and Mars bars and some early morning office cleaning vans filling up before their shift. Further along the river, and on the other side, I could see the Palace of Westminster. I smiled to myself. If only the MPs really knew what the intelligence services got up to. According to the news on the radio, chances were that we'd have a new government soon. Not that I could vote for anyone. I hadn't existed in real time as Stone, Stamford, Stevenson or anyone else for years. I did a full circle of a roundabout, and headed back on the same road towards Vauxhall for one more drive past. I still had time to kill, so I stopped in the garage and bought a drink and a sandwich. The RV point still looked fine. My plan was to pick up Simmons, make distance and angles as we walked to my car, and go for a drive. That way I controlled the environment. I could protect myself as well as him. I parked up about 400 metres west of the RV. While eating my sandwich, I checked out my route back to the car. I got out and walked down the road, arriving at 4:05. There was still nothing to do but wait, so I window shopped at the bike shop, resolving that I really would buy one as a gift to myself. No, more than a gift. A reward. At 4:20, I moved into the shadows of the railway arches opposite the exit point that I knew Simmons would use. There were one or two people wandering about, clubbers on their way home or to another club. Their drunken laughs shattered the still morning air. Then there was silence again. I could tell it was him straight away, leaning slightly forward as he bounced along on the balls of his feet. I watched him branch right from the exit and stand at the pedestrian crossing, intending to head for the metal footbridge over the five-way road junction to the railway station. I waited. There was no rush. I would let him come to me. As he crossed the road, I came out of the shadows at the bottom of the footbridge steps. He smiled. "Nick, how are you?" He kept walking, nodding left towards Lambeth Bridge. "Shall we walk?" It wasn't a question. I nodded the opposite way towards my car. "I've arranged a pickup." Simmons stopped and looked at me with the expression of a disappointed schoolteacher. "No, I think we'll walk." I was sponsoring the RV. He should have known that I'd organized for our safety. He stared at me for a few more moments and then, as if he knew I was going to follow, continued on walking. I fell into step beside him. Ahead of us, on the other side of the Thames, the Houses of Parliament glowed in the dark like a picture postcard. We were on a wide pavement that abutted a grass section, and then there was another pavement that serviced the shop outlets that were part of the archways. Simmons looked the same as ever, his tie about half an inch loose, the shirt and suit looking as if his wardrobe was a carrier bag. "So, Nick, what have you got?" He smiled, but he didn't look at me. As I told him the story, he didn't interrupt, just kept his eyes on the ground, nodding. I felt like a son unloading his problems onto his dad, and it felt good. We'd been walking for about a quarter of an hour, and I'd come to the end of my presentation. It was his turn to talk. I somehow expected him to stop, or at least find a bench where we could sit, but he carried on walking. He turned his head towards me and smiled again. "Nick, I had no idea you'd be so thorough. Who else have you spoken to about this?" "No one else. Only De Sabatino and Ewan." "And has Ewan or this De Sabatino also got a copy of the discs?" I lied. "No. No one apart from me." "Even when you come to someone for help, you never play your full hand. You never know when you might need an edge." He remained incredibly calm. "What we have to ensure is that no one else finds out. Not for the moment, anyway. This is more than low-level corruption. The links with Pyra, Gibraltar, and, it seems, the DEA mean this is very grave indeed. You seem to have made a pretty good fist of this so far, so let me ask you something." He paused as if he was a judge about to give his deliberation. "Do you think it goes further?" "Fuck knows," I said. "But you can't be too careful. It's why I wanted to talk to you on your own." "And where is the brown child now?" I lied again. "In a hotel, fast asleep. I'll be needing some help to pass her on to her grandparents." "Of course, Nick. All in good time." We walked on a while in silence. We got to a bar on the corner of a car tunnel under the railway line. Simmons turned to the right, taking us under the arches. Then he spoke again, and it was as if there was no question of me not complying with his demand. "Before I can do anything to help you, what I need from you, of course, is the evidence." He was still not looking at me, but making sure he avoided the puddles of water stained with engine oil. "I haven't brought the discs with me, if that's what you mean. Nick, I shall do my best to see that you both have protection, but I do need the proof, and all copies of it. Can you get them for me now?" "Not possible. It won't be for a few hours." "Nick, I cannot do anything without them. I need all copies. Even ones you'd normally leave in that security blanket of yours." I shrugged. "You must understand that it's for my own protection." We turned right again and were now heading back towards the station, paralleling the railway. For a couple of minutes we moved in silence along narrow, warehoused streets. Simmons was deep in thought. A freight train rumbled above us on its way to waking up the residents of southwest London. Why the fuck was it so important for him to know how many copies there were and get his hands on all of them?
Believe me, I shouted above the noise. I've got that side all under control. I've been fucked over enough. You know as well as I do that I've got to protect everyone, including you.
Yes, of course. But I need to control all the information. Not even you should have it. There is too much risk involved. This was getting stupid.
I understand that. But what if you get zapped? There would be nothing to back up what I'm saying. It's not only the Americans' corruption, don't you see? Gibraltar was a setup. It includes us.
Simmons slowly nodded at a puddle in the gutter.
A few things puzzle me, I said. Why were we briefed that the bomb would be initiated by remote control? How come the Int was so good about the ASU, but so wrong about there being no bomb?
Still, he gave no reply. Things weren't adding up here. Oh, fuck. I felt as if I'd been hit on the back of the head by a fire extinguisher again. Why hadn't I thought of it? The freight train's rumbling was now in the distance. The early morning silence had returned.
But you know all this, don't you?
No reply. He didn't even break his stride.
Who had briefed us that the Gibraltar bomb was going to be initiated by remote control?
Simmons, who was there at Alpha to oversee it. Why the fuck hadn't I thought of it before?
I stopped in my tracks. Simmons kept walking.
This isn't just an American pirate thing, is it?
It's much bigger. You are part of it, aren't you?
The rear arches were more light industrial than retail. Car repair shops, sheets, metalworks, and storage units, most with company vans that had been parked outside for the night. On our left, about 20 meters away, was a grassy area that belonged to a council estate. Then, flats beyond that. All around us were metal refuse containers and large, red recovery vehicles, with yellow warning lights on their roofs. He turned to face me, and took the 6 steps back to where I stood. For the first time, we had eye to eye.
Nick, I think you need to be aware of something. You will give me all the information, and I mean all of it. We cannot take the risk of other copies being in circulation.
The look on his face was of a chess grandmaster about to make the decisive move. The shock and horror on mine must have been plain to see.
We didn't necessarily go along with the Americans' determination to kill you, but you should be in no doubt that we will do so now if we have to.
We?
It's much bigger than you think, Nick. You're intelligent. You must realize the commercial and political implications of a ceasefire. Exposing what is on the discs would mess up much more than just what you know. It's very unfortunate about Kevin and his family, I grant you. When he told me what he'd discovered, I did try to talk my American colleagues into a subtler course of action.
So that was why I'd been ordered back to the UK so abruptly. Once Simmons had talked with Kev, he wanted me out of the US, and quick. He didn't want me speaking to Kev, or interrupting his murder. I thought of Kelly. At least she was safe.
It was almost as if he was reading my mind.
If your choice is not to give me all the information, we will kill the child, and then we will kill you, after extracting what we need.
Don't be naive, Nick. You and I were the same. This isn't about emotion, this is business, Nick.
Business. He looked at me as a father would a wayward son.
You really have no choice.
I tried to fight it. He had to be bluffing.
Ewan sends his regards, by the way, and says that he managed to get a television set for her bedroom.
Believe me, Nick, Ewan will kill her. He rather likes the financial benefits.
I shook my head slowly from side to side.
Think back. Who initiated the contact?
He was right. It was Ewan. Simmons was there to direct it. Ewan was there to pull the trigger. But I still fought against the idea. He opened his jacket and pulled a mobile phone from his inside pocket. Let Ewan explain. He was expecting a call later anyway. He turned on the power and was waiting to put in his PIN number. He smiled as he looked down at the phone's display. This is how the Americans found you, you know. People think that detection can only take place when the phone is in use. Not so. As long as they're switched on, these things are miniature tracking devices. Even if no calls are made or received. It's actually a form of electronic tagging. We find it terribly useful. He tapped in his PIN number, the tones blaring out of his hand. However, once you'd given them the slip at Lawton, our only option was to let you make entry back into the UK. I needed to know what you'd found out. I have to say, I'm so glad your cancer treatment was successful. Fuck. He hadn't even mentioned my lack of hair. That was because he already knew. But Ewan, he'd been aware enough to mention it. I felt sick knowing he was using his skills against me. Simmons smiled. He knew he had me by the bollocks. Nick, I'll say this again. I really do need all the discs. You know the child would suffer greatly. It's not something that we would enjoy, but there are important matters at stake. I wanted so much for him to get through to Ewan. I wanted to speak to him. Wanted him to confirm that it was a bluff. But in my heart of hearts, I knew that it wasn't. Simmons had nearly finished tapping in the number. I had no choice. I couldn't risk Kelly. He wasn't going to make this call. With my right arm in a hooked position, I swung round hard and connected with his nose. There was a dull crunch of fracturing bone, and he went down with a muffled moan. While he writhed on the ground, I kicked his case under one of the recovery trucks and, in the same motion, picked up the phone in my left hand, got behind him, and positioned it at the front of his throat. Grabbing the other side with my right hand, I jammed it firmly under his Adam's apple. I looked to the right and left. We were too exposed where we were, and what I had in mind would take several minutes to complete. I shuffled backwards, dragging him in between two of the trucks. I got down onto my knees, all the time pulling back on the phone. He was kicking out, his arms flailing, trying to rip my face apart. His whimpers and chokes filled the air. I responded by leaning forward, using the weight of my upper body to bend his head down, so that his chin was more or less on his chest. At the same time, I pulled even harder. Just another 2 minutes and I'd be done. After 30 seconds, he started to struggle furiously, with all the frenzied strength that a man draws on when he knows he is dying. But no matter what he did now, he wouldn't be getting up. His hands still scrabbled at my face. I bobbed and weaved to avoid them, but maintained the pressure on his throat. Already the scabs from the fight with McGear had been pulled off, but I couldn't feel much blood. Then he managed to get his fingernails into the cut just below my eye. I stifled a scream as his three nails started to make entry into the already damaged soft skin. I made the injury worse by pulling my face away. As I did, Simmons's nails took my skin with them. I didn't bother now to see if anyone was watching. I was beyond caring. I was fighting for breath myself with the effort, and sweat stung the injuries on my face. Gradually, at first, his movements subsided to no more than a spasmodic twitching in his legs. His hands stopped grasping. Seconds later, he was unconscious. It crossed my mind just to get up and walk away, to leave him to suffer the effects of hypoxia and be brain damaged for life. I decided against. I wanted this fucker dead. I gave it another 30 seconds. His chest stopped moving. I put my fingers on the carotid pulse and felt nothing. I dragged him to the wall and sat him up against the doors of a unit. Then I got to my feet and started dusting myself down. Keeping to the shadows, I tucked my shirt in and wiped away the sweat and blood with my sleeve. I checked the phone. It had been turned off in the fight,
I wiped my prints off it, then just left everything where it was and casually walked away. If anybody had seen me, so what? It didn't really matter. I had more important things to worry about. I drove west, holding my coat cuff against my eye to stop the bleeding. The whole situation was still spinning around inside my head, slowly beginning to make sense. I now knew how Luther and Co. had found me. They must have beaten the number out of Pat and traced the signal while I had it switched on, waiting for his call. If I'd let on to Ewan or Simmons that there was only one more set of backups in my laptop and had handed it over, I'd have been dead. They were covering their asses but retrieving the information. Had Simmons arranged to phone Ewan sometime after our meet? Ewan was over 3 hours away, and Simmons's body would be discovered soon. If Ewan found out, he wouldn't take any chances. He would move location, maybe even kill her straight away. Either way, I'd have lost her. This time there was no question of just leaving her. I could call her on the mobile and tell her to run, but what would that achieve? She was in the middle of nowhere. Even if she ran for half an hour, it would make no difference. Ewan's house was in the middle of acres of mountains, grass, rocks and sheep shit. He would find her. I could call the police, but would they believe me? I could waste hours trying to convince them, by which time it would be too late. Or they might take it on themselves to raid Ewan's house, and the result would be the same. For a fleeting second I thought about Big Al. I hoped he'd be well out of it by now. He didn't have getaway accounts for nothing. If he'd transferred 400 grand into mine, for sure he'd have taken 800 for himself. Old Melonhead would be okay. I cut him from my mind. The motorway services just before Heathrow were being signposted. I had a thought. I pulled off onto the slip road and drove into the car park. Now all I had to do was get to a phone and make a call. Chapter 39. The service station was busy. I'd had to park 100 meters from the main entrance. I got out of the car just as the heavens opened. By the time I reached the bank of 4 telephones outside the Burger King, I was soaked. The first two I tried only accepted cards. I had about £3 in change in my pocket. Not enough. I ran into the shop, wiping my face to get some of the blood off. I bought a newspaper with a fiver and walked out. The woman, looking worried at the state of my face, I then went back in and got a packet of Rolos with a £10 note. The woman looked even more scared. Maybe she thought I had seen her staring. She was just happy for me to take my change and see me leave. As I dialed the number, I felt a knot in my stomach, as if I was a teenager phoning to arrange his very first date. Would she have charged it and left it switched on? Why shouldn't she? She had never let me down before. It started to ring. For a moment I felt like a child in a sweet shop with his dad, hardly able to contain my excitement. Then I had new things to worry about. What if Ewan had the phone now? Did I hang up or did I try to bluff it and maybe find out where she was? It was too late to think. The ringing stopped. There was a pause, then I heard a quiet, hesitant, "Hello? Who is it?" "Hi, Kelly, it's me, Nick," I said, trying for all the world to sound Mr. Casual. "Are you on your own?" "Yes. You woke me up. Are you coming back now?" She sounded tired and confused. I was trying hard to think of an answer. Thankfully, she carried on. "Ewan said that I may be staying with him for a while now, because you have to go away. It isn't true, is it, Nick? You said you wouldn't leave me." It was a bad line. I had to put a finger in my other ear to hear her above the noise of the rain on the glass of the phone box. A lorry driver in the next box was shouting loudly and angrily, arguing with his boss that he couldn't go any further because of his tachograph, and he wasn't going to lose his license just to get a few boxes of bloody anoraks up to Carlisle. On top of that was the steady boom of traffic on the motorway and the noises of people coming in and out of the services. I had to block all that out and concentrate on the phone call, because I couldn't ask Kelly to speak up. I said, "Yes, of course, you're right.
I will never leave you. Ewan is lying to you. I've found out some bad things about him, Kelly. Are you still in the house?
Yes, I'm in bed.
Is Ewan in his bed?
Yes. Do you want to speak to him?
No. No, let me think for a minute. My mind was racing now, trying to think of the best way to say what I wanted. Of course, I'm coming to get you. In fact, I'll be there very soon. Now listen, I need you to do something very difficult and very dangerous. You only have to do this one thing for me, and everything will be over. The moment I said it, I felt like a lowlife.
I don't have to run away from the people again, do I?
No, no, no. It's not like that this time. But it's the most special job a spy ever does. I didn't want to give her time to think, so I just carried on. But I want to check something first, okay? You're in bed, aren't you? Get under the covers and only talk to me in a whisper, okay? I could hear all the rustlings as she got underneath the covers.
What are we going to do, Nick?
First, I want you to look at the front of the telephone and press a number. It will then light up. Tell me if you can see a picture of a battery. How many blocks are there where the battery sign is? Can you see it? I heard some scufflings.
I can see that.
How many blocks are there in the picture?
Three. There's three blocks. One of them is flashing.
That's good. It wasn't really. Two blocks meant she hadn't recharged it, and the battery was down to less than half power. And I was going to need a lot of airtime to talk her through the whole process.
What's that noise? She said.
The truck driver was now really pissed off and was hollering down the phone, the roll-up in his hand making the phone box look like a steam room. Nothing to worry about. Kelly, I'm going to tell you what to do. But you need to keep listening to me on the telephone. Can you do that?
Why is Ewan bad, Nick? What?
Listen, Kelly. Ewan wants to hurt me. If he finds you doing this thing for me, he will hurt you too. Do you understand that? I could hear lots of rustlings. She was obviously still under the bed covers. Then there was a very quiet...
Yes.
She wasn't sounding a happy bunny. I was sure there was a better way I could be going about all this. I just didn't have time to think what it might be. If Ewan wakes up, I said, or if the telephone stops working, I want you to leave the house very, very quietly. I want you to go down the track to the road and hide behind the trees, just by the big gate that Ewan drove through to get to his house. Know what I mean?
Yeah.
You must hide there until you hear a car come and stop. But don't get out from your hiding place unless it toots its horn two times. Then come out. Do you understand that? I'll be in the car. It's a blue Astra, okay? There was a pause.
What's an Astra, Nick?
Shit, she was 7 years old, an American. What was I expecting? Okay, I'll stop in a blue car and come and get you. I got her to repeat it, and for good measure, I said, so if Ewan wakes up and sees you, I want you to run to the trees as fast as you can and hide. Because if Ewan catches you doing what I want you to do, we will never see each other again. Don't let me down, okay? And remember, don't you come out from behind those trees, even if Ewan calls for you, okay?
Okay. You will come and get me, won't you?
There was a bit of doubt in her mind. Of course I will. Now, first of all, what I want you to do is get out of bed. Then, put the phone on the bed and get dressed, very slowly and quietly. Put on a nice, thick coat. And you know those trainers that you've got? Make sure you take those as well, but don't put them on yet. I heard her put the phone down and start rummaging around the room. For fuck's sake, hurry up. I forced myself to calm down. It was almost 2 minutes before I heard,
I'm ready, Nick.
Now, listen to me very carefully. Ewan is not a friend. He has tried to kill me. Do you understand, Kelly? He has tried to kill me. There was a pause.
Why? I don't understand, Nick. You said he was your friend.
I know, but things change. Do you want to help me?
Yes.
Good. Then you must do exactly what I tell you. I want you
to put your trainers in your coat pocket. Okay? Now it's time to go downstairs. I want you to keep the telephone with you, all right?
Yeah.
Time was running short, and so was my money. Just remember, you must be very, very quiet, because otherwise you will wake Ewan. If that happens, you run out of the house towards the hidey hole, promise?
Cross my heart.
Okay. I want you to creep very, very gently down the stairs. Don't talk to me again until you're in the kitchen. From now on, what we must do is whisper all the time, okay?
Okay.
I heard the door open. As she came out of the room, I imagined her passing the bathroom on her left. Ahead of her, up a half landing and about 12 feet away, would be the door to Ewan's room. Was it open or closed? Too late to ask her. A few steps now, and she'd be at the top of the main stairs and next to the old grandfather clock. On cue, I heard its slow, ponderous tick-tock. It reminded me of something out of a Hitchcock movie. The sound receded very slowly. Good girl. She must be going down the stairs very carefully. Only once did I hear the creak of a board, and I wondered again about Ewan's door. Did he usually sleep with it open? I couldn't remember. At the bottom of the stairs, she'd be turning back on herself to the right, heading towards the kitchen. I tried to imagine where she was, but lost her in the silence. At last, I heard the barely perceptible sound of a protesting hinge. That was the kitchen door. I felt a stab of guilt for using the girl like this. But she knew the score. Well, sort of. Fuck it. The decision was made. I just had to do it. If it worked, fine. If it didn't, she was dead. But if I didn't try it, she was dead anyway, so let's get on with it. She whispered,
I'm in the kitchen, but I can't see very much. Am I allowed to turn the light on?
It was the loudest whisper I'd ever heard.
No, Kelly. You've got to speak very slowly and very quietly. Like this.
I demonstrated.
And don't put the light on. That would wake Ewan up. Just go more slowly and listen to me all the time. If you don't understand anything, just ask. And remember, if anything goes wrong or you hear a noise, stop. And we will both listen, okay?
Okay.
The problem with her being quieter on the phone was that it was harder to hear her. The lorry driver had now finished, slamming the phone down and storming into the Burger King. A woman took his place and was gobbing off to a girlfriend. The kitchen was two areas knocked into one. The old back room of the house and what had used to be an alleyway between the house and the old sheep pen wall. The alleyway had been covered by a conservatory, with all the kitchen units arranged galley-style in one long range beneath it. There were plants on pedestals and a large circular wooden table in the middle of the area. I hoped she wouldn't knock anything over onto the squash court floor. Thinking of the nights we'd spent rescuing the wood made me shudder at all those years of friendship, trust, and even love. I felt let down, used, fucked over. There couldn't be much battery time left.
Everything okay?
I said. I tried hard not to convey any sense of panic, but I knew we would be in trouble soon. If the phone went dead, would she remember what I'd told her to do?
I can't see anything, Nick.
I thought for a few seconds, trying to remember more of the layout.
Okay, Kelly, go very slowly to where the sink is. Go and stand by the hob.
What's that?
It's the bit you cook on with saucepans. You see it?
Yeah.
Okay, there's a switch on the right-hand side. Can you see that?
I'll look.
A moment or two later, she said,
Nick, I can see now.
She must have switched on the small fluorescent lights that illuminated the worktop of the kitchen. She sounded relieved.
Good girl. Now, I want you to go back and very gently close the kitchen door. Will you do that for me?
Okay. You are coming for me, Nick.
I wasn't feeling confident about this at all. Should I stop it now and just get her to open the door for me and wait? No, fuck it. He might be getting a phone call any minute about Simmons's death. Of course I am. But I can't come unless you do what I say, okay? Keep the telephone to your ear and very gently close that door. I heard the telltale creak. What I want you to do now is go and have a look under the sink and put all the bottles and things on the table. Will you do that for me?
Okay.
There was silence, then a soft clatter as she moved bottles and cans around.
That's everything out now.
Well done. Now very quietly, read out the labels to me. Can you do that?
No, I can't.
Why not?
There's too many things and it's too dark. I can't do it.
She was sounding under pressure now. There was that wobble in her voice. Fuck, this is taking too long. It's okay, Kelly. Just walk over to the light switch by the door and turn the light on. Don't rush. Will you do that?
Okay.
It sounded as if her nose was blocking up. I knew the sound so well by now. The next stage, if I wasn't careful, would be tears and failure. I heard her shuffling towards the light switch.
I can see now, Nick.
Okay, now go back and read to me what the labels say, okay?
Okay.
She moved back to the table, and I could hear her pick up the cleaning products.
Ajax.
Okay, Kelly, what's the next one? Fucking hell, this was outrageous. I held the phone hard against my ear, almost holding my breath as I silently willed her to succeed. I was really pumped. I could feel my heart going. I was writhing like a madman in a straitjacket, twisting and turning in the kiosk, miming Kelly's actions to myself. I looked across at the other box. The woman who was talking to her friend had wiped the condensation from the glass to get a better view of me, and now seemed to be relaying a running commentary. I must have looked like a mass murderer, with cuts and scratches on my face and my hair and clothes soaking wet. The loud noise of metal clattering onto wood made me jump. Kelly? Kelly! Silence. Then the phone was picked up.
Sorry, Nick. I knocked a spoon off. I didn't see it. I'm scared. I don't want to do this. Please come and get me.
It wasn't long before the crying was going to start. Kelly, don't worry. It's okay. It's okay. I heard sniffing on the phone. No, not now, for fuck's sake. It's okay, Kelly, it's okay. I can't get you unless you help me. You must be brave. Ewan is trying to kill me. Only you can help me. Can you do that for me?
Please hurry, Nick. I want to be with you.
It's all right. It's all right. It wasn't all right, Nick, because Nick's fucking money was disappearing. I was down to my last few pound coins. They weren't going to last. I put another coin in, and it rattled out into the coin return. I had to scrabble for another one. She started to go through more of the labels. Most of the words she couldn't read. I asked her to spell them. As she got three letters out, I worked out the rest. No, that one's no good. Read the next one. My mind was now racing, trying to remember ingredients and formulae. At last, she read out something I could use. Kelly, you must listen very carefully. That's a green can, isn't it? Put it where you can find it again. Then I want you to creep out to the room next door, where the washing machine is. You know the one?
Yes.
Ewan had a place for everything, and everything in its place. I even knew that his forks would be lined up beside each other in the drawer. Just by the door is a cupboard. And in it, there's a blue bottle. The label says antifreeze.
What?
Antifreeze. A-N-T-I. I want you to bring it to the table, okay? The phone clunked onto the worktop. I started to flap even more. After what seemed an eternity, she came back on.
I got it.
Put it on the table and then open it. I heard the phone go down again and lots of heavy breathing and sniffing as she struggled with the bottle top.
I don't know how to do it.
Just twist it. You know how to open a bottle?
I can't. It won't go. I am trying, Nick, but my hands are shaking.
I then heard a soft, long moan. I was sure it was going to turn into crying. Shit, I don't need this. It isn't going to work. Kelly? Kelly, are you okay? Talk to me. Come on, talk to me. I was getting nothing. Come on, Kelly, come on! Nothing. All I could hear was her holding back tears and sniffing.
Nick, I want you to get me. Please, Nick, please.
She was sobbing now. Just take your time, Kelly, just take your time. It's okay, everything's okay. I'm here, don't worry, okay? Let's just stand and listen. If you can hear anything, you tell me on the phone, okay? And I'll try to listen at the same time. I listened. I wanted to make sure Ewan wasn't awake. I also wanted a cut. There needs to be a cut in the action at a time like this. Otherwise the errors snowball and people start tripping over themselves. So let's take our time. But at the same time, be as fast as possible. I knew exactly what I needed to do. But the frustration lay in trying to interpret it to this child, under pressure, and to get her to work quietly. And all the time I was running out of money, and the mobile was running out of battery life. The woman left her booth and gave me a grin of appeasement, in case I was going to lunge at her with a meat cleaver. Are you okay now, Kelly?
Yes. Do you want me to unscrew the bottle still?
I couldn't understand why she couldn't do it. I started giving her more instructions. Then I remembered. The bottle had a childproof screw top. As I started to tell her how to undo it, there was a soft bleep. Battery. Shit. Yes, remember to push the top down before you turn. We just have to be a bit quicker or the phone is going to stop before we finish.
Now what do I do, Nick?
Is that on the table with the top undone? Nothing. Kelly? Kelly, are you there? Was the battery dead? Then I heard,
what do I do now?
Thank goodness. I thought the battery had gone. Is there anything you can open that green can with? I know, use the spoon, Kelly. Very, very carefully now, pick it up. Put the phone on the table and then open the can, okay? I listened, running through all the different options that were left if this scheme fucked up. I came to the conclusion there were none. Now, here comes the hard part. Do you think you are good enough for this? You've got to be pretty special to do this bit.
Yes. I'm okay now. I am sorry I cried. It's just that I'm...
I know, Kelly. I am too. But we will do this together. What I need you to do now is put the phone in your pocket with your trainers. Then take one of those big bottles from the table and walk to the front door of the house and open it just a little bit. Not wide open, just a little bit. Then put the bottle behind the door to stop it swinging shut. Now remember, it's a big, heavy door, so I want you to do it really slowly. Really, really gently, so it doesn't make a noise. Can you do that for me?
Yeah, I can do that. What happens after that?
I'll tell you in a minute. Now don't forget, if the phone stops working, and you can't hear me anymore, I want you to run to the trees and hide. Chances were Ewan would find her. But what else was there to do?
Okay.
This was going to be the wriggly bit. Even if he was sound asleep, Ewan's subconscious was likely to detect the change in air pressure and ambient noise when the door was opened, and make something of it in a dream, giving her a sort of sixth sense feeling that something was wrong. If so, at least she'd have a head start. So long as she remembered what I'd told her.
I'm back in the kitchen. What do I do now?
Listen to me. This bit's very important. How much can you count up to?
I can count to 10,000.
She was sounding a little happier now, sensing the end was in sight. I only want you to count up to 300. Can you do that?
I can do that.
You've got to do it in your head.
Okay.
First, I want you to go to the hob again. You know how to turn on the gas?
Of course. Sometimes I help Mommy with the cooking.
I'd never felt so sad. I made myself concentrate again. There was no room for distractions. She might be dead soon anyway. I felt enough of a bastard for getting her to do my dirty work. While I was at it, I might as well make sure she did the job properly. That's good. So you know how to turn on the gas in the oven and all the rings on the hob?
I told you, I know how to cook.
A coachload of teenage kids returning from a school holiday trip was streaming into the burger bar. A gang of 6 or 7 of them hung back and headed for the phones, laughing and shouting in newly broken voices, all trying to cram into the one vacant booth. The noise was horrendous. I couldn't hear what Kelly was saying. I had to do something. Kelly, just wait a minute. I put my hand over the mouthpiece, leaned out of the box and shouted, You! Shut the fuck up! I've got my auntie here, her husband's just died, and I'm trying to talk to her, okay? Give us some time. The kids went quiet, their cheeks red. They sloped off to join their friends, sniggering with mock bravado to disguise their embarrassment. I got back on the phone. Kelly, this is very important. The phone might stop soon because the battery is running out. I want you to turn on all the gas on the cooker. Take the phone with you so I can hear the gas. Go there now while I talk to you. I heard the hiss of the bottled propane that Ewan used.
It's very smelly, Nick.
That's good. Now, just walk out of the kitchen and close the door. But be very quiet outside the room. Remember, we don't want to wake Ewan. Don't talk to me anymore, just listen. Go outside the room and close the kitchen door, okay?
Okay. I won't talk to you anymore.
That's right. I heard the door close.
Nick?
I tried to keep calm.
Yes, Kelly. Can I get Jenny and Ricky to take with me, please?
I tried harder to keep myself in check. No, Kelly, there is no time. Just listen to me. There isn't time for you to talk. I want you to count up to 300 in your head. Then I want you to take a really, really deep breath and walk back into the kitchen. Don't run. You must walk. Go into the kitchen and pour all the antifreeze into the green can. Then I want you to walk out of the kitchen. Don't run. I don't want you to wake Ewan. If she tripped up and hurt herself, she could get engulfed by what was about to happen. Walk out very slowly, close the kitchen door behind you, then go out of the house and close the front door really, really gently. Do not collect Jenny or Ricky.
But I want them. Please, Nick.
I ignored her. Then I want you to run as fast as you can up to the trees and hide. When you're running, you will hear a big bang, and there will be a fire. Don't stop and don't look back. And don't come out until I get there, no matter what happens. I promise I will be there soon. It was at times like this that I was pleased I'd done all the laborious, parrot-fashioned learning of techniques for making incendiaries and improvised explosive devices. At the time, many years ago, it had been mind-bogglingly boring. But it had to be done because you can't take a notebook on the job with you. I learned, off by heart, how to make bombs from everyday ingredients and how to make improvised electrical devices. As clearly as even atheists remember the Lord's Prayer from the time it was drummed into them at school, I remember the formulae and step-by-step mechanics for making everything from a simple incendiary like the one I was going to use to kill Ewan, mixture number 5. To a bomb that I could initiate by using a pager from the other side of the world. The phone started bleeping urgently, and then it just went dead. I visualized the glycerin in the antifreeze working on the mixture. In 40 or 50 seconds it would ignite. If it was damp, maybe a little longer. Kelly had less than a minute to get out of the house. The instant the gas was ignited, there was going to be a massive explosion and then a fire. Hopefully it would take Ewan down. But would it take her with it? Please, please, please don't go after those fucking teddy bears. I ran back to the car and started driving west. First Lights was just trying to fight its way through the clouds. Chapter 40. It was the worst journey of my life. I saw a sign saying Newport 70 miles. I raced along at warp speed for what I guessed was 30 miles. Then another sign told me Newport 60 miles. I felt as if I was running on a treadmill to nowhere and the treadmill was waist deep in water. My body had calmed down from all the excitement and was telling me I was hurt. My neck was agony. The flow of blood had stopped, but the eye Simmons had gouged was starting to swell up and affect my vision. Ewan, the fucker. The friend I'd trusted for years. It was almost too painful to think about. I felt numb. I felt bereaved. In time, maybe that numbness would turn to anger or grief or some other thing. But not yet. In my mind's eye, all I could see was the look on Kelly's face as the train left the station, and the smile on Ewan's. Where did I go from here? No fucker was going to move against me because they'd know that I still had the files. If the plan worked, Ewan's package would sit in the sorting depot now there was no one to deliver it to. The killing of Simmons would be covered up, no matter what. If some zealous policeman started getting too close to the truth, he'd get stitched up. John Stalker wasn't the first it had happened to, and he wouldn't be the last. It all made sense to me, now, that every time peace talks began, Pyra, or someone claiming to be Pyra, had dropped a soldier or policeman or bombed the mainland UK. And why? Because it was good business to keep the Troubles alive. There were plenty on our side who profited from conflicts like Northern Ireland and didn't want them to end. The RUC is probably the highest paid police force in Europe, if not the world. If you're its chief constable, it's your duty to say that you want an end to the war. But the reality is that you've got a massive police force under your command and limitless amounts of resources and power. Within that force, there are many empires that have evolved purely because of the Troubles, each of them getting whatever material and manpower they ask for to further their fight against terrorism. Even if you're a 24-year-old RUC constable, married with two kids, why would you want the Troubles to stop? You earn enough to enjoy a high standard of living, have a nice house, take foreign holidays. Why would you want to see peace and, in turn, redundancy? The British Army doesn't want it to stop either. The province is a fantastic testing ground for equipment and training ground for troops. And, as with the RUC, it means the Army gets a bigger slice of the cake. Every year the Army has to justify its budget. And it's up against the Navy, who are asking for more funds for Trident submarines. And the Air Force, who are banging on about needing to buy the Eurofighter 2000, or at least replace the Flying Coffin, the Tornado. With Northern Ireland on the agenda, the Army can talk about a now commitment, an operational imperative. And nobody's going to argue against the need for funds to fight terrorism. As for the squaddies, they don't want to lose the chance of 6 months a year in Northern Ireland on extra money, with free food and accommodation. After all, they joined the army to go on operations. That was what I had done, and I thought it was great. British industry stood to lose substantially from a ceasefire. Major defence manufacturers designed equipment specifically for the internal security role and made fortunes out of the operational conditions. Equipment that was battle-proven in Northern Ireland was eagerly sought after by foreign buyers. No wonder the conflict had made Britain one of the top three arms exporters in the world, with beneficial effects on the UK balance of payments. I knew now why McCann, Farrell and Savage had had to die. Enniskillen. The backlash against Pyra. People signing books of condolence, Irish-Americans stopping their donations. There must have been a real danger of a time of dialogue and reconciliation. Simmons and his mates couldn't have that. They had to create martyrs to keep the pot boiling. And me? I was probably just a very small glitch in a well-oiled machine. Come to that, Northern Ireland was probably only one item among many in their company accounts. For all I knew, these guys also provoked killings and riots in Hebron, stirred up Croats against Serbs, and even got Kennedy killed because he wanted to stop the Vietnam War. As Simmons had said, it was business. There was nothing I could do to stop them. But I wasn't worried about that. What was the point? The only thing I had achieved, perhaps, was revenge for Kev's and Pat's deaths. That would have to be enough. I got off the motorway and onto the dual carriageway to Abergavenny. The rain had stopped, but it was a stretch of road notorious for repair works. Ewan's house was about 10 miles the other side of the town, on the road towards Brecon. I weaved in and out of the traffic, other drivers hooting and waving their fists. Then in the distance, I saw the red of brake lights. The morning rush hour had started. I slowed with the volume of traffic heading into the town and eventually came to a complete standstill. The jam was caused by resurfacing work, and it looked as though there was a mile-long tailback. I drive onto the hard shoulder. As I sped past them on the inside, stationary motorists honked angrily. The noise alerted the workers laying the tarmac up ahead. They ran and shouted, trying to wave me down, gesticulating at the roadwork sign. I didn't even acknowledge them. I only hoped I didn't get caught by the police. I dropped a gear, made speed and changed back up. I got to Abergavenny and stayed on the ring road. I got stopped at a long set of traffic lights and bumped up onto the curb, edging my way to the front of the queue. Once I was over the other side of the town, I started to come into open countryside and the road narrowed to a single carriageway. I put my foot down and bombed along at 70 to 80, using the whole road as if it was my own. Seeing a left-hand bend, I moved over to the far right-hand side. I could hear the hedgerow screech against the side of the car. From this position, I could see more of the dead ground round the bend. Not bothering with brakes, I banged down through the gears to second just before turning. Once on the bend, I put my foot down and made use of rubber on tarmac. Out of the bend, I block changed to fourth and kept it there. After a mile, a slow-moving truck was taking up most of the road. Its large container of sheep on two floors had a sticker on it asking me if I thought the driving was okay. If not, to ring head office. I had plenty of time to read it, labouring behind the fucker at 20 miles per hour. The road twisted and turned. He could see me in his mirrors, but there was no way he was going to pull in for me to overtake. The speedo dropped to 15 miles per hour, and I looked at my watch. It was 9:35, and I'd been on the road for just under 3 hours. I kept pulling out, looking and tucking back in again. Even the sheep were looking at me now. The truck driver was enjoying himself. We had eye to eye in his wing mirror, and I could see he was laughing. I knew this road, and I knew that unless he let me overtake, I was doomed to several miles of driving at his pace. By now, the road had a 2-foot mud bank on each side, then trees and hedges. It was wet and slippery, with small streams running along each side. I'd have to take a chance and just hope that nothing was coming. On this road, all corners were blind. Preparing for the next bend, the truck driver shifted slowly down through the gears and I accelerated past him on the wrong side of the road. If there was anything coming round the bend, we'd both be killed. He flashed his lights and honked, probably doing his best to distract me and force me off the road. For the first time today, I was in luck. The road was clear, and I'd soon left the truck far behind. A quarter of an hour later, I was at the turnoff for Ewan's Valley. I threw a left and, within 100 meters, the road petered out into a single lane. If I came up behind a tractor or farm machinery, there would be few passing places. But luck stayed with me, and there was nothing ahead. Another 20 minutes and I got to the valley. And, as I approached the brow of the hill, I could already see the spiral of smoke. Chapter 41. The walls were still intact, but most of the roof had collapsed, and there was smoke and scorch marks around the window frames. 2 fire engines were in attendance, and the firemen were still damping down. They looked wet, tired and stressed. On the other side of the house was an ambulance. A handful of people had gathered, locals in their barbers and wellies, who'd driven from the other side of the valley to Rubberneck. I drove on and stopped by the gate. A couple of firemen turned round, but they didn't say anything. They were too busy doing their work. I got out of the car and ran across the road to the small copse, about 50 meters away, hollering and shouting like a madman. Kelly? Kelly? Nothing. It's me, it's Nick! You can come out now. but she wasn't there. Deep down, I'd probably known all along that she wouldn't be. She'd been dead from the moment she'd picked up the phone. I turned away and walked slowly up the track towards the throng of spectators. They gave me the once-over, obviously not liking the look of my damaged face, then turned back, more interested in the remains of the house. "Was there anyone in there?" I asked, nobody in particular. A woman spoke.
"His lights were on last night, and the ambulance crew have been inside. Oh, it's such a shame. He was such a nice young man."
I walked beyond the group, and a fireman came towards me, lifting a gloved hand.
"Excuse me, sir, if you could stay well back. We haven't made the area safe yet."
"Radio Wales," I said, trying to make myself sound official. "Can you tell me what happened?" I looked over his shoulder. Other firefighters were dragging out charred contents of Ewan's house and placing them on a pile that was being damped down. I could now smell the burning. I looked back at the fireman. He said,
"It looks as if there was a fire, and then the gas bottles blew up. If you could move back, sir."
"Was anyone killed or injured?" As I asked, something one of them threw on the pile caught my eye. It was Jenny or Ricky, one or the other. I could never tell which was which. Not that it mattered now. Whichever one it was burned black, with only half an arm left. "It will take some time before we know for sure, but no one could have survived that blast." He was right. In any other circumstances, it would have been an explosion to be proud of. Kelly was dead. Maybe it wouldn't be too bad. It would be a fucker, but I'd get over it. What could I have offered her? Kelly would have been in shit state when she realized what had happened to her, and would have needed psychiatric treatment. Besides, she'd been starting to like the way we'd been living. Her death would tidy things up. I wouldn't have to protect or worry about her anymore. I turned and started back towards the car, deep in my thoughts. What was done was done. I couldn't change it, couldn't turn the clock back. I'd find out more from the news. Behind me in the distance, I heard the squawk of a bird. Maybe a crow. It almost sounded like my name. I stopped and turned. And there she was, running towards me from beyond the trees. I started to run towards her, but checked myself. I wanted to make it look casual, even if my insides were shaking off the Richter scale. She flew into my arms and buried her face in my neck. I pulled her back and held her at arm's length. "Why weren't you at the trees?" I was half angry, half relieved, like a parent who thinks he's lost a child in a crowd, and then finds her again and doesn't know whether to give her a good old bollocking or just a hug and a kiss. I didn't know what to do, but it felt good. "Why weren't you by the trees?" where I said. She looked at me in disbelief.
"As if. Because you always make sure you stand off and watch. You told me that."
I got hold of her hand, grinned and said, "Yeah, fair one." Still smiling, we carried on along the track. She was soaked, her hair matted to her head. We reached the car and got in without exchanging another word. I looked at her in the rearview mirror. We had eye to eye. She smiled and I snapped, "Put your seatbelt on." I turned the key in the ignition, and we drove off. Remote Control is published by Random House Audiobooks, a division of the Random House Group. Copyright Andy McNab, 1997. Copyright and recording, Random House Audiobooks. Andy McNab has asserted his right under the Copyright Designs and Patents Act, 1988, to be identified as the author of this work.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.